I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's November 14th, and we have a lot to talk about. If you're someone who's living with MS, you probably don't need me to remind you that multiple sclerosis is hard to diagnose. And so MS ends up being misdiagnosed way too often, which leaves some people who don't have MS receiving expensive disease-modifying therapy that they don't need, and it leaves other people who do have MS still not being treated with the disease-modifying therapy that's been shown to slow disability progression and preserve their quality of life longer, all because doctors are getting the diagnosis wrong. And that hasn't gone unnoticed. A team of international experts sponsored by the America's Committee on Treatment and Research in MS has published a paper that provides updated guidance for healthcare professionals on clinical approaches to diagnosing MS. Returning to the podcast to talk about diagnosing and misdiagnosing MS is the lead author of that paper, Dr. Andrew Solomon. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Solomon, there are a few other things that you should know about. Neurofilament light chain, also referred to as NFL, is a protein that's released into the bloodstream as a result of nerve damage in the central nervous system. And the results of a large study from the University of California, San Francisco, demonstrate that elevated levels of neurofilament light chain in the blood can predict MS disability progression 1 to 2 years before that disease worsening actually occurs. In this study, researchers measured the NFL levels in 1,899 MS patients who were already being followed in two different studies. One study being conducted by the University of California, San Francisco, was following 609 people who were living with MS, and a study in Switzerland was following 1,209 people who were living with MS. In both of these completely different studies, participants were already receiving annual assessments that included assessing their neurofilament light chain level for up to 10 years. So the UCSF research team compared trends in NFL levels with the timing of confirmed disability worsening, which in this case was defined as a meaningful increase in the patient's expanded disability status score, or EDSS, that was confirmed in a follow-up visit with their neurologist at least 6 months later. Just as a quick refresher, EDSS is the method that neurologists use to quantify disability in MS. It uses a scoring system of between 0 and 10 to characterize the level of disability in someone living with MS. And the result of this analysis showed that NFL levels were notably higher about a year before confirmed disability worsening that was associated with an incomplete recovery from an MS relapse. Now, we also know that disability worsening can occur independent of relapse activity. And in those cases, NFL levels still tended to rise, but the increase was more gradual, anywhere from 1 to 2 years before disability worsening was confirmed in clinic. This evidence would seem to validate neurofilament light chain as an early biomarker of future disability worsening. Keep in mind that an individual's NFL level can be measured in a simple blood test. So, seeing an increase in a patient's NFL level could prompt a neurologist to adopt a more aggressive MS treatment strategy, and that could mitigate that future disability worsening. Now, there are a lot of coulds in that last sentence, which means that there are opportunities for future clinical trials to determine whether a more aggressive clinical response to an increase in a patient's NFL level might mitigate or eliminate that disability worsening that's going to occur 1 to 2 years later. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Since 2018, we've been following the progress of ATA-188, an investigational stem cell therapy from Atara Biotherapeutics. This therapy used programmed T cells to seek out and destroy B cells that were infected with the Epstein-Barr virus. Evidence shows that the Epstein-Barr virus is a trigger for MS. And the theory behind ATA-188 was if you could eliminate the immune cells that carried Epstein-Barr virus in people who were living with MS, you could mitigate their MS itself. Last week, Atara Biotherapeutics reported that the Phase 2 study of ATA-188 in non-active progressive MS did not meet its primary endpoint of confirmed disability improvement at 12 months compared to placebo. The company also reported that fluid and imaging biomarkers failed to provide any further supportive evidence, and as no benefit was identified, the company plans to stop the clinical trial. While this is a disappointing outcome, it's not to say that the research team didn't learn things from this clinical trial. To put this scenario into some context, I'll reshare my favorite story about the inventor Thomas Edison. Keep in mind that Edison made more than 10,000 attempts at inventing the electric light bulb. When someone asked Edison how he could continue his work while experiencing 10,000 failures, he said, "I didn't think of it that way. I thought I was discovering 10,000 ways not to invent the light bulb." And that's a great example of how failure still propels science forward. And just to be clear, this doesn't mean that the Epstein-Barr virus isn't a trigger for MS. It only means that this specific therapy, using T cells that have been programmed to kill B cells carrying the Epstein-Barr virus, does not appear to have a therapeutic effect on people already living with MS. To say that we talk a lot about MS research on this podcast would be an obvious understatement. Right now, as you're listening to this, there's remarkable research taking place in laboratories all around the world, and I try to make that often complex science more accessible by translating it into easier-to-understand English. But most, if not all, of that research depends on you. Your participation is the engine that drives research forward. And I'm always happy to remind you of opportunities for you to participate in MS research, especially when you can participate without having to leave the comfort of your own home. So if you were born female and identify as female, and you're between the ages of 18 and 100, and you're living with MS, I have a research opportunity to share with you. NYU Langone Health is conducting a survey to understand how women living with MS would like to learn about sexual health related to their MS, with the ultimate goal of creating one or more education tools. The survey is completely anonymous and takes about 20 minutes to complete. You'll respond to questions about your current disease status, current sexual health, and your preferences regarding sexual education. You know, there just isn't much available in the way of resources that focus on MS and women's sexual health. This is your opportunity to change or at least improve that situation. So if you're interested in completing this online survey, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Evidence has shown us that starting a disease-modifying therapy early effectively slows MS disease progression. Well, now there's evidence that reminds us that it isn't just about starting that DMT, it's about adhering to your treatment plan and staying on that DMT. Results from a real-world study out of Italy show that a high level of adherence to a disease-modifying therapy is associated with a 25% lower risk of experiencing moderate to severe MS relapses among previously untreated people living with MS compared with those who fail to adhere to their DMT. Now, high adherence in this study was defined as having access to disease-modifying therapy for at least 80% of the days in a given period of time. and non-adherence was defined as having access for fewer than 60% of the days in a given period of time. In this study, the research team analyzed data from 2,528 people living with MS in northern Italy who received their first prescription for disease-modifying therapy in the years 2015 through 2019. And over a five-year follow-up period, 13.5% of these patients had at least one moderate to severe MS relapse, which was defined as admission to a hospital or emergency room for MS, and or the use of corticosteroids at a dose of at least 0.5 grams per day for 5 days. The result of the analysis showed that compared with patients who had access to their DMT for fewer than 60% of the days covered, those patients who had access to their DMT for at least 80% of the days covered had a 25% lower risk of experiencing moderate to severe relapses. The results of this study underscore the importance of working with your neurologist or MS specialist to identify not only a disease-modifying therapy that you both expect to be effective, but one that's going to align with your preferences. I think it's pretty easy to imagine that someone is going to be more likely to adhere to a treatment plan that aligns with their personal preferences. One of the things that the research team in this study noticed was that over the years of the study, again that's 2015 through 2019, there was a growing increase in patients opting for oral or infusion DMTs, which the researchers attributed to increases in prescriptions for Tecfidera or its generics, and Ocrevus. So this is where that concept of shared decision-making becomes important. Adherence to any treatment plan is going to be higher if the patient is a partner in creating that plan. So consider this one more important reason for those conversations between you and your neurologist to be dialogues and not monologues. Now, if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Starting a disease-modifying therapy early requires that you first get a reliable diagnosis. But diagnosing MS can be tricky, and delays can sometimes mean faster disability progression down the road. Joining me in a moment to talk about the new guidance for healthcare providers that's designed to make diagnosing MS more straightforward and that MS diagnosis more reliable is my guest, Dr. Andrew Solomon. I think we all grow up believing that when you're sick, you go to the doctor tells you what's wrong, and you get treated. It sounds pretty simple. But when it comes to being diagnosed with MS, it isn't always that straightforward. In 2019, Cedars-Sinai Medical Center and UCLA Medical Center, both in Los Angeles, reported that 1 in 5 patients who had been referred to Cedars-Sinai Medical Center's MS Center or UCLA's MS Center over the course of 1 year had been misdiagnosed. Now think about what that means. Imagine spending years on a disease-modifying therapy that you never needed in the first place. Or knowing how important early intervention is, imagine not receiving that disease-modifying therapy when you did need it, all because you were misdiagnosed. Joining me to shed some light on optimizing the process of diagnosing MS is Dr. Andrew Solomon. Dr. Solomon is a professor of neurological sciences and division chief of multiple sclerosis at the University of Vermont Larner College of Medicine, and he's an internationally recognized expert on MS diagnosis and misdiagnosis. Dr. Solomon was the lead author on a consensus paper written by international experts and sponsored by the America's Committee on Treatment and Research in MS. The paper provides updated guidance for healthcare professionals on clinical approaches to diagnosing MS. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Solomon.
Thanks for having me.
I'll start by asking the obvious question. Why is MS so difficult to diagnose?
MS can certainly sometimes be quite difficult to diagnose. I think the short answer is that there's so many ways in which MS can affect a patient and the nervous system and produce symptoms. We like to say it's a heterogeneous disorder. There are a variety of ways patients can first have symptoms. And that can make it hard sometimes to differentiate MS from other disorders.
Can you explain what the McDonald criteria is and its role in diagnosing MS?
Part of the reason why MS diagnosis is hard is we don't have a test for MS. So unlike other disorders, we don't have a blood test or that can just tell us, you know, with high probability what the diagnosis is, or rule it in or rule it out. So MS is a clinical diagnosis. It relies on a neurologist synthesizing and thoughtfully considering a lot of different data, how a patient describes their symptoms, what their neurologic exam, like a physical exam, shows, other data from MRIs, what MRIs findings a patient might have on their brain MRI or spinal cord MRIs, and the results of different tests, blood tests, and sometimes we evaluate spinal fluid by something called a lumbar puncture. The McDonald criteria is something that helps predict a diagnosis of MS utilizing all that information. So this is a criteria for the diagnosis of MS, but it relies on a neurologist first identifying a syndrome or a constellation of symptoms and neurologic exam findings or MRI findings typical of MS. So they have to think about and rule out other disorders, better explanations for what the patient is experiencing in order for the McDonald criteria to work. So there's the McDonald criteria has sort of a number of pillars. So that's one of them is no better explanation, right? So we have to rule out other disorders in the process of using this diagnostic criteria and in order to use it, in fact. And then we have to identify a patient with a syndrome that's typical for MS. These include things like optic neuritis or inflammation of the optic nerve, myelitis, inflammation of the spinal cord, a variety of syndromes associated with inflammation in the brain stem, which is an area between the brain and spinal cord. Type of progression of neurologic symptoms over a year. Some of these are quite typical presentations for MS. So that's a starting point. We need to look for some explanation for those symptoms in order to use the McDonald criteria, something we call objective evidence of a lesion. So an area in the nervous system that explains the symptoms. So we look either by our neurologic exam or an MRI. And then there are two other elements of the McDonald criteria called dissemination in space and time. So there are different ways to fulfill these elements of the diagnostic criteria, but we're making sure that there's different areas of the nervous system that are involved, which is quite typical for MS, dissemination in space, and that there's evidence of disease over time, that there's changes over time that's typical of MS. So all of these elements are kind of key in order to confirm a diagnosis, but it's tricky because you have to be constantly thinking about other disorders that can mimic MS throughout this process.
I'm going to circle back to some of those other disorders in just a moment. I've heard it said that time equals brain. Can you talk about why getting a timely and accurate MS diagnosis is so important?
Yeah, I mean, I think the short answer is that the sooner we diagnose somebody, the earlier they can start treatment for MS. And there's been a lot of evidence in the last few years in particular that early treatment of this disease results in less risk of disability. So patients who are treated quite early in the disease process seem to have better outcomes short term, as well as recent data suggesting long term outcomes. So years later, patients who receive early treatment are doing better. And there's a lot of, I use this word heterogeneity or variants. Patients have different flavors or versions of MS, and it's hard to predict sometimes. And there's a lot of uncertainty, which can be quite hard for patients and doctors, quite honestly. But people are doing better than they used to. And we think part of the reason is that we were able to treat people early. And the reason why we're able to treat people early is we're able to diagnose people quite early now using these diagnostic criteria. We're able to confirm a diagnosis of MS much quicker than we used to.
Well, as you mentioned a moment ago, one of the things that can make diagnosing MS tricky is that symptoms of other health conditions can mimic MS symptoms. Can you talk about some of the specific disorders that mimic MS and how they can make getting an accurate diagnosis more challenging?
Sure. There's a long list, and it can be daunting sometimes to think about all the disorders that can mimic or overlap with MS. But these studies, like Dr. Casey's study that you alluded to in California, that have focused on misdiagnosis of MS, suggest that there's a lot of common disorders that are being mistaken for MS. They're not rare or sort of like very difficult to identify disorders. These disorders are things like migraine. Migraine can cause neurologic symptoms as well as MRI abnormalities. Sometimes patients also have MRI abnormalities due to common disorders like high blood pressure or diabetes that don't explain their symptoms, but lead to misdiagnosis of MS. And in those cases, perhaps a neurologist is sort of relying too much on the MRI and not thinking enough about this idea of objective evidence we talked about, that those lesions actually correspond to the patient's symptoms. We need that in order to make a diagnosis of MS. Some of these misdiagnosis studies suggest that sort of an over-reliance on MRI, where we talked about earlier, to make a diagnosis of MS, the clinical findings, the symptoms and the neurologic exam matter just as much as the MRI. And I think some of us are relying a little bit too much on MRI to make the diagnosis sometimes, and not thinking about, think critically about the clinical symptoms. Sometimes MS can have very challenging symptoms, so it's not always easy. So we see common disorders. We see other autoimmune disorders that can have central nervous system manifestations that are mistaken for MS sometimes. And there are clues, if we ask carefully sometimes, of patients, you know, if they're having other symptoms outside the nervous system, that might give us a clue that they have something other than MS and something that involves their joints, for instance. And lastly, there are a couple of disorders that we used to think were MS that we now know are actually different than MS. They have a different underlying cause. They have a different prognosis and they have different treatment. And these have long names. One is called myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein associated disease, and one is called neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. And these disorders can present quite similarly to MS, but there are tests to diagnose them, and there's diagnostic criteria. And these disorders, have been misdiagnosed with MS, and so there's growing appreciation for how to recognize those disorders rather than MS. MS is still quite common. So many patients who present with syndromes typical for MS still have MS, but we need to think about these other disorders too.
Well, to that point, as I mentioned when I introduced you, you were the lead author in a paper that provides updated guidance for healthcare professionals in arriving at that differential diagnosis. Can you share some of the ways or how the guidance has been updated?
Sure. You know, in some regards, there are diagnoses we just didn't know about. And, you know, when the last paper was published on this topic, a last consensus paper, was in 2008. And so there's a number of new syndromes that have been identified that can cause optic neuritis or MRI findings that are similar to MS. And we have clues in this paper we call red flags that might help guide clinicians towards those disorders rather than MS. I think we also have learned to appreciate that there's more nuance in untangling whether optic neuritis, for instance, inflammation of the optic nerve, or myelitis in the spinal cord is caused by MS or something else. So it's not enough to just identify those disorders, but there are characteristics of those disorders, the length of the lesion in the spinal cord or the optic nerve, or how the optic nerve is affected, where in the optic nerve the lesion is, and these sort of things can help us get a clue that it may be something that's atypical for MS, and we should be looking at other disorders. So this paper looks at that as well, like critically at the syndromes that are typical for MS, but characteristics of those syndromes that may suggest something else. And we have a lot more data on that, I think, in the last 15 years, learning from all these other disorders. And, you know, we collected 22 international experts to give their input on what was important for clinicians for this paper.
I want to mention a couple of terms that some of my listeners may not be familiar with. Can you explain what a central vein sign and paramagnetic rim lesions are and how they can help provide a more accurate MS diagnosis?
That's a great question. These are two findings that have gotten a lot of attention in our field recently. Let's start with central vein signs. So we have known for a long time, you know, 1800s even, that the lesions in the brain in MS caused by inflammation seem to be centered around a vein. There's something about that relationship that is very common in MS, that the inflammation sort of happens around that vein, and maybe the inflammatory cells come out of that vein there. and cause that damage. But we have only recently been able to see that on MRI using specialized sequences. And so we see that a lot of MRI white matter lesions have a vein in the middle. What turns out to be interesting is if you look at the proportion of lesions on a given MRI, so there's lots and lots of disorders that can cause what we call white matter lesions on an MRI that look like MS. But if most of those lesions have a vein in the middle, it seems pretty helpful to make a diagnosis of MS. So this idea of central vein sign is not just that you see a vein in a lesion, but that the proportion of lesions tells us something. So it's not a perfect test yet, and there's a lot of work to be done, but it seems very promising that we can use this in the future, where a patient shows up with some symptoms and they get an MRI, and we can also get some sense of how many of those lesions have a central vein. And that could also be important information to complement our diagnostic process. Paramagnetic rim lesions are sort of a similar, what we call maybe diagnostic biomarker, so a promising diagnostic biomarker. They're also an MRI finding. And these white matter lesions on MRIs that patients with MS have, some of them have a dark rim around them. Now, the finding of this rim is not in every patient. So unlike central vein, which is very, very common in patients with MS, some studies suggest about half of patients with MS have this dark rim around some of their lesions. And again, this seems like it's specific for MS. We're not seeing this in many disorders that can mimic MS. Unlike central vein, there's also some prognostic importance for this finding. It seems like this may represent smoldering inflammation. And some patients who have these rims may have more disability in some studies. So it's also a potential treatment target. You know, we're looking at if new treatments for MS can resolve these rims. And so it's something that will probably be used in clinical trials for new MS therapies in the future. But both of these findings are new and very exciting. But right now, if you think about it, they're still subjective, right? So somebody has to look at all these lesions and look at if there's a little dot in two different views to see if there's a vein in the middle and decide if it's the middle. And somebody has to look around this lesion and decide, is there something dark there? And how dark is how dark and like what's the threshold? Like how dark is enough to have a dark rim around the lesion? So there's some work to be done, and there's a large study going on there right now. It's quite exciting by the North American Imaging and MS Cooperative, looking at 400 patients who presented for evaluation for MS, and we're testing, you know, how well some of these new imaging biomarkers may help us with diagnosis in the future. I'm optimistic, and it's a matter of trying to figure out how to improve diagnostic accuracy with them without resulting in errors or mistakes, right? Which you know, we don't want to call something a rim or call something a central vein if it's not. And so there's a bit to figure out still, but these are very promising biomarkers, and I'm hopeful in the next 5 years we'll be using them, but it may take a little time.
Well, speaking about the next 5 years, you know, rapid advances in technology have accelerated the rate of scientific discovery in a way the world has never experienced before. The National MS Society says that we've made as much progress in understanding MS in the past 5 years than we've made in the previous 70 years. So looking ahead, how might MS be diagnosed in the future?
I'm hopeful that we'll have blood tests and some automated imaging assessments that, and maybe spinal fluid testing that can give us markers that are highly specific for MS. You know, that's something that's, as I mentioned at the beginning, is lacking in our field. Wouldn't it be nice if somebody could get a test and we could just tell them they have MS rather than this process of ruling out other disorders and multiple tests, you know, over the course of time. So, you know, there is progress on blood tests, but not quite as much as imaging right now. But there's a lot of people looking at proteins in the blood that have shown a lot of promise at how we might manage MS and monitor disease activities. I think that's going to change. Some of those might also help us diagnose MS. And I think, you know, some of these imaging markers, like we discussed, they're just sort of tip of the iceberg. We'll find some others. And there may be a way to use artificial intelligence, which everybody is excited about, to analyze the MRIs to give us sort of a sense of, for instance, how many lesions have a central vein. There are a number of groups working on that. Or how many lesions have a rim lesion. So we're not relying on, you know, somebody squinting at an MRI to make that determination on their own. But I still think, you know, neurologists are going to, you know, have to, like in all of medicine, have to sort of synthesize this data and evaluate it. I don't know that a computer is going to make this diagnosis without us, because, you know, there's a lot of, as we talked about, variation in MS, and it's not easy. So I think that we're going to have some tools that are going to speed up diagnosis and help us diagnose MS more quickly, and particularly in people who have maybe presentations that are not classic or typical, and help us rule out MS and prevent misdiagnosis. I'm excited. I think there's a lot of potential for change in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, Dr. Andrew Solomon, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/324. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.